Bon Radio. Reflecting American society's burgeoning, if somewhat misguided, proclivity towards morality and its modern corollary, shopping, today is Family Values Day here on Calvos and Damien's New Music Sesquihour Expansive. The value portion of the show stems from our special end-of-year clearance, a 2-for-1 compositional deal. All you have to do is listen to half a program with special guest Jody Diamond, and you get a second special guest, Larry Polanski, absolutely free. What a value! And they're related to each other. What a family! A family value! What more could a sentient listening audience want? Well, if you know, just ask us. Dial Glipsob and please have your credit card ready. Because of today's dual guestmanship, Dmitry Kabalevsky, winner of the People's Artist Award of 1963 and whose 91st birthday was this morning, will not be featured on this, the 32nd episode of the New Music Sesquihour, no matter that it is in fact being featured even now as I speak. However, if you, our listening audience, are not in fact now listening, then the duality is moot, and Larry and Jody beat Dmitry 4-2. As a service to our burgeoning listening audience, the International Classification of Musical Diseases will not be discussed on today's show. But be forewarned, one Saturday afternoon down the road, we may not feel so charitable, radiophonically speaking, and then not only will we discuss it, but it may even constitute that program's theme, quiz, guest composer, and Le Flambeau Orange.
Le Flambeau Orange.
Do you like Kipling, goes the unilaterally famous
Kipper? Kipper? Do I like Kipper?
Do you? Kipling.
Kipling. Rudyard Kipper. Rudling Kipling.
The punchline is rapidly deteriorating.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Goes the unilaterally... I think we can skip this paragraph.
Would you like to begin it again? I'll talk about Robert Louis Stevenson instead.
Do you like Robert Louis Stevenson? Goes the unilaterally famous, if unburgeoned, question, followed post-haste by the snappy riposte, I don't know, I've never kippled. And while you're all recovering from outbursts of hearty guffaws, let's take a quiet moment to honor the old Rudster's 130th birthday. Okay, that's enough. The date is 1853. The place, Peter the Hermit's Cantina in Mexico's Mesilla Valley. The time, 8:15 a.m. Six men are seated at a booth near the lone window. They are, in order of net height, a locomotive mechanic, a haberdasher, American diplomat Jim Gadsden, and two-thirds of the Fennel Barbershop Quartet. All are drinking cafe lattes, although only the haberdasher is using a cup. A spray of violets sits pensively in a spittoon in the center of the table, surrounded by an unfinished hand of Whiskers Six Straw. From an adjoining room can be heard the strains of an automatisch Klavier plunking out the food fight theme from Norma in the Susquehlidian mode. A photograph, a forerunner to the video game, is tacked to the wall. It depicts 400 owls attempting en masse to outwit a giant badger in the rain. A Mexican official in a terry cloth robe enters the cantina, carrying a rectangular strip of land. It measures 29,640 square miles, yet weighs only 50 pounds.
Thank you.
He drops it onto the table, tipping over the spittoon and scattering the Whiskers' six draw cards, and smiles at Gadsden. Gadsden smiles back, withdraws Manhattan Island and several strings of fashion beads from his coat pocket, and hands them to the Mexican. The haberdasher smiles. The Mexican nods, stuffs Manhattan Island in a sack, grabs the beads, and leaves, pausing momentarily to puzzle over the photograph. The locomotive mechanic sighs, but then smiles as the Fennel members suddenly burst into song, their exploded torsos splattering the table and much of what will one day be termed Gadsden's Purchase. And speaking of purchase, you too can purchase this portion of Calvos and Damien's new music sesquihour, which up to now is being brought to you by this portion of Calvos and Damien's new music sesquihour, but which will in the future be available for procurement at many fine retail sesqui outlets. Check our program guide for one near you. What more needs to say, Kabbalaskalian speaking? Only that the clock beats time again for Sovlak of the LPs.
And so it is, Sovlak it is, as the LP doth turn, playing the Kabalevsky, which was not to be heard, Symphony No. 4, which was not to be heard with the Leningrad Philharmonic Orchestra, no longer heard that way, no longer and still not conducted by Dmitri Kabalevsky. Family Values Day, what do you mean?
Why, I thought I mentioned it. I thought it was perfectly clear.
Do you remember back when we had Les Gray, that they used to tell us that our bodies, if we were values of our bodies, were 85 cents? I figured this out.
Yes, 85
cents. If we have an average of 3.5 people in a family, that means that a whole family's value is $2.97.5. $2.98. That is a bargain, and even with inflation, considering inflation of perhaps 100%, gosh, we're... $5.99 specials here.
Now, wait a minute. You say 2.5?
Something like that. No, 3.5.
3.5. Isn't that splitting hairs?
No, that's not if you are splitting a sesquihair. That's already split.
I understand.
It is Calvos and Damien's new sesquihour.
What
else could it be? And we are listening, indeed, not listening to Kabalevsky Symphony No. 4, which we'll do for just a few moments. A very few. Here it is.
Conclusion. I think climax coming. Are those final chords or what?
Those were indeed final chords.
You just can't hear final chords like that in modern music these days.
That's right.
But maybe we'll find a different type later on in the show.
We will have different chords. We'll have chords, and we'll have tandems, and we'll have tensions, and we'll have perimeters, and we'll have radii.
Wow.
And ulna. Let's listen to something new, something that you have obtained.
I did. I was in the purchase mode not long ago, and I heard this performance a bunch of years ago by New York composer Tom Johnson. It's called Failing, a very difficult piece for string bass.
A piece called Failing by Tom Johnson has become somewhat of a classic modern or new music piece for the double bass. It's subtitled a very difficult piece for solo string bass, and I think you'll soon see why. Because during this piece, Failing, I'm required to read a long text while I play music written above the text. The text must be read out loud at a more or less normal pace, and I must not allow the music to slow me down. The task is fairly easy for a while, because there's not much music, and most of it comes at the end of clauses and sentences, almost like normal punctuation. Later on, there was more music, and the task becomes more difficult. So difficult, in fact, that I will probably not be able to do it without either slowing down my reading speed or else making mistakes in the music. At least the composer feels confident that I will eventually begin to run into trouble, which is why he called the piece Failing. So far, the task is still not that difficult. But the challenge is that as the piece becomes more difficult, I must continue reading the text at a normal pace and playing the music as well as possible, just as I did at the beginning. By now, I'm already rather busy just playing the notes and reading the text. But the text says that I should also try to listen to what I am doing as much as possible and speak loud enough to keep a balance between the speaking and the playing. Ideally, both the speaking and the music should flow easily and naturally so that the audience can easily follow either element at any time. Sometimes the music has a strong aggressive quality, and I have to speak quite loudly to be heard. At other times, the music is lyrical, almost sentimental, and I must speak more softly so that the speaking will not cover up the music. But I should make sure that the text is always easy to understand. If I allow my voice to fluctuate with the rises and falls of the music, the text may become difficult to understand, and that too would be a form of failing, because the text makes it clear that the speaking should always be easy for the audience to understand, regardless of what happens musically. By now, this task is already rather challenging, but I have practiced the piece quite a bit, and that's a fact, as well as just simply a line in the text. So, unless I'm having a particularly bad night, I can still handle the music quite adequately without slowing down my delivery of the text. I should be able to keep everything well in tune and even play the dynamic markings accurately. If I am concentrating well, I should even be able to maintain a good balance between the speaking and the playing. And remember the technique of text always easy to understand. Sometimes the music changes radically, but soon the music becomes more difficult to get, and I will probably start failing one way or another. I should point out, however, that I am not obliged to fail. After all, the audience cannot see the score I am reading, and no one would ever be the wiser if I were to simply leave out whatever passages I am unable to play. People might be very impressed by my playing and think that I had succeeded in playing a piece which the composer thought could not be played successfully by any bass player. But of course, by leaving out the hardest part like that, I would be cheating, and the performance would not really be a success at all, since the piece is about failing. By now, failing is extremely difficult. That is, the piece called Failing is extremely difficult. Oh, there are a few relaxed moments now and then, but most of the time, I am required to play a tricky chromatic melody at a fast speed, and by now, I am probably beginning to fail in one way or another. Of course, I don't particularly enjoy failing, and sometimes I think it would be better if I cheated a little, so that I would not fail too badly, and so that people would be more impressed by my playing ability. But, on the other hand, if I do my best and play most of the music well, it should be clear that I am doing the task as well as anyone could expect me to do it. Moreover, I will be interpreting the piece accurately, since it is obvious that failing is about failing. And if I succeed in playing everything accurately without slowing down my speaking or cheating or anything, I will fail and thus miss the point. In a way, I almost want to fail, because everybody fails in certain times and in certain ways anyway, and because that is what the piece is about, and because I want to interpret it appropriately. But of course, I must not try to fail. I must try to succeed in doing the task well, without slowing down and without missing notes, even though by now it is almost impossible to succeed for very long. If I tried to fail and then failed, that would be a kind of success and not a failure at all. So I must try to succeed. That way, when I fail to succeed, I will succeed in communicating the essence of the piece, even though I will fail to accomplish the task as it is set up. In other words, I will not be able to fail unless I'm trying to succeed, and I won't succeed in interpreting the piece sensitively unless my performance turns out to be a failure. Or, putting it another way, I will probably succeed in failing to succeed. Not only because the music is so difficult, but also because if I fail to succeed, I will fail to fail, and thus miss the point, since failing is obviously about failing. And since any successful performance must be a qualified failure. In any case, I am continuing to rig the test and play humor as much as possible, attempting to maintain a normal pace and make the text comprehensible. And I am probably continuing to fail here and there. But I should not be failing quite as often now as I was before, because the music is returning to some of the more lyrical material. Even that material is difficult to play as expressively as I would like under these circumstances, but at least there is not much danger that I will miss notes. And if I concentrate well, I can even maintain a good balance between the speaking and the playing. Soon, however, I will be faced with a fresh difficulty. The text is about to run out, but the music continues for another minute or so. During that time, I must decide for myself what to talk about as I play. My remarks are to be genuinely improvised and should include specific references to this particular performance and to the degree to which I have been failing, or failing to fail, or failing to succeed to fail, or whatever. As before, I must continue to speak at a normal pace, in a normal tone of voice, and maintain a balance between the speaking and the playing. As an additional challenge, I am supposed to link the written part of the text with the improvised text so smoothly that no one will be able to tell exactly where the improvised speaking began and the written text left off. I can do this by one of two ways. One is by doing something like I did at the beginning of the piece and say a few introductory remarks so you were not able to tell where the piece actually began. Like you can't really tell where this sort of thing left off. But as you've probably guessed by now, I'm well into the improvised part of the text. And it's not a very easy thing to do to try to make up a text like this on the spot that's in the same style as the text I've been reading. But I don't have to say too much more now because I only have about three more notes to play, so I know I won't fail anymore. And after I play these last two notes, I hope you won't fail to show your appreciation.
From Bang on a Can Live, that's Tom Johnson's Failing, a very difficult piece for string bass, played and spoken and entertained by Robert Black.
Hubba, hubba, hubba.
Yeah, it's a great piece. After it got started, I realized I'd heard that performed live, thought it was absolutely wonderful. And Larry Polansky, who's here relaxing and getting ready for his moment on the stellar radio of WGDR in about 45 minutes. He knows the piece as well. It's a wonderful thing, wonderful thing. How did you manage to stumble across that in the great hinterlands?
Believe it or not, it was in the not on sale bin, which is one bin that I don't normally associate with purchasing. But it
is that why it still has this little anti-theft tag on it? I understand.
Oh yes.
Okay. Jody Diamond is our guest today, our first guest today on Calvos and Damien's New Music Sesquire. And Jody is, I would say, is a bit of an odd character because I cannot quite understand how it is that Jody got to the notion of doing what is essentially music from half a world away here in America and is editor. Are you also publisher of Balangan, the magazine newsletter of Indonesian music? Is it a worldwide newsletter, American newsletter?
We have subscribers in over 15 countries, which happens to also be the number of over that many of countries in which one will find gamelan ensembles, either imported from Indonesia or locally built.
How did this happen? How did you get involved with this? And how did... I recall, of course, from my early days hearing some of the cage pieces, which were in imitation of the gamelan sound, the prepared piano pieces. But how did it make its way into your life?
When I was 17, someone took me into a big room at California Institute of the Arts and said, "Look at these."
Ooh.
And I looked around at all these instruments, and I didn't have the vaguest idea what they were at all. And it was the first thing I'd encountered in my life I couldn't fake an answer to. So I thought, well, maybe I don't know everything after all. And I had to sit down and start learning, and kind of got hooked and haven't really come out of that room since. Right. That was about 25 years ago.
Wow. Well, we had Dennis Murphy on the show a couple of months ago, and Dennis built a gamelan here in Vermont, here at the college, as a matter of fact.
Well, not only did Dennis build a gamelan at Goddard, but he is credited as being the first American composer to ever build his own gamelan instruments. So it's quite amazing to be in Plainfield, where he lives, and I go up on the hill and worship at his feet as often as I can. And in a town of this size, we now have two gamelan orchestras, which is also quite unusual. So there's Dennis's ensemble, the Plainfield Village Gamelan.
Right.
And last year, the Goddard College bought a large Javanese bronze, iron, and brass ensemble, which has the name Gamelan Sulu Kala.
Explain that about gamelans, how they're named and why they're named, and also a little bit about how this large instrument is one instrument as well as being separate components.
Well, imagine if every time someone made a piano, which if they were in their right mind, they would do so, choose a tuning that would be unique to that instrument.
Okay.
So you'd lift up the keyboard and you'd play it, and the contour of the piece might be the same as one that you knew, but the actual pitches that would come out would be a little bit different and would have an individual sound that belonged to that piano. Well, that would give it such a strong character, you might well name it, like the Venerable Torrent of Honey piano, or the Venerable Lake of Flowers piano,
Lake of Flowers.
The Sesqua piano. So a gamelan is somewhat the same way. It's a large ensemble of instruments, but it has an individual tuning. There's no standard tuning. They haven't gotten the idea yet in Java, or they've managed to keep it away, that every set of instruments should have the exact same pitches or scale.
So this would have a real appeal to, I would guess, contemporary composers in some respect who are trying to break out of the mold of the sort of piano tuning.
Well, it just kind of shows you that something that you thought was music is only a music.
Ah, yes. Excellent. Let's listen to some of this, one of the musics. This is a combination kind of a piece. Why don't you give us about a minute or two about this?
Don't any faithful listeners think we're about to present you with classical turn-of-the-century Javanese court gamelan, although that's a very nice music. The piece we're about to hear is called Titik Api, Point of Fire.
Point of Fire, that's a wonderful name.
It's by an Indonesian composer named Harry Rusli, who actually runs one of the biggest electronic music studios in Bandung, which is the Paris of West Java, it's called. And Harry Rusli is very interested in both Western music and various kinds of existing traditional musics in Indonesia. He has a percussion degree from the University of Amsterdam, I think, and studied in Europe for quite a while and returned to Indonesia. This was actually one of the last pieces that he wrote using a text, because every time he would write a piece with words, he would get thrown in jail by the Indonesian government.
Yes,
and after he came back from Europe, he said, I know, I'm just writing instrumental music from now on, and that was it. So this was done in 1977 and was his attempt to mix, as so many people have tried to do, even our very own students here at Goddard, the instruments of the ubiquitous rock ensemble with the ubiquitous in Java gamelan ensemble.
Let's hear it. I'm very anxious for this one. This is Titik Api, Point of Fire by Harry Rusli.
Jadi pancekaran.
opening excerpt from Point of Fire, Titik Api, by Harry Rusley, recorded in 1977, you said.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I definitely would not have imagined a composition like that from the traditional court gamelan that I have heard.
Yes.
And even from the kind of music that Dennis Murphy played with his ensemble when he played at the Vermont Composers Festival in Putney when he did his Thumis melody.
Well, Dennis's music draws quite a bit on classical Javanese models. It's been a problem for experimental composers in Indonesia, actually until over the last 5 years or so, I think partly due to the work that Larry and I did during the year we were living there, that when the government sends a troop out to represent Indonesian traditions, they don't tend to send the crazy people.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's actually, a lot of doors are opening. A lot of Japanese composers and choreographers have been working with Indonesian composers. There have been a lot more new music festivals in Australia and Europe that have been inviting Indonesian artists. And we produced 3 CDs on Lyricord and one
and
Leonardo Music Journal that's all new music by Indonesian composers.
We have, as a matter of fact, played Wayan Sadra's On and On a couple of times and excerpts from a few of the other pieces on that one of those CDs. So. Yes, we have heard those. Well, let's hear a little bit more. Tell us what
we've
got next.
Well, speaking of Sadra, I have another piece here that he did when he was in residence at the Dartmouth Electronic Music Studio a few years ago in 91, which was during a big festival of Indonesia that had people traveling all over the country. Larry will give you the cut number on that one.
Okay.
And this was a piece, it was a challenge for him that he gave to himself, to take a few Javanese and Balinese instruments into the studio.
A so few meaning?
A few, like three.
Okay.
And some bamboo flutes, and work with one of the then graduate students, a fellow named John Pewterbaugh, to integrate that with the electronic equipment that was there. It's like, well, what can you do with all this stuff? And this piece was his answer. He called it work in progress because he never was sure where it was going to go. And, of course, every time we performed it, it was different. So this recording is just one of the steps along the way.
Great. It almost seems like a natural relationship in the work that's been done in some of the electronics and the kind of sound that you can produce with gamelan instruments.
Why do you say that?
Because, hearkening back to something that we played a couple of weeks ago, played an excerpt from... Stockhausen's Gesang der Jünglinge, and also Contact from back in those days. We had a very nice privilege of having a copy from the master tape here. And the kind of percussive sounds and the percussive sounds that are not based on Western percussion that he was able to make a rise out of that, and the kind of influences that have come right on along seem to bring us to a point where it could fit very nicely together.
Yes, but I think you have to remember that what to us is an instrument whose pitches are breaking rules is total normality to the Indonesian composer who's grown up with it. So that's the normal part.
Right, right.
It doesn't seem at all unusual or different tones. That's what he has to start with.
But the relationship with those kinds of sounds and those kinds of percussion things with which I am not as familiar seems to bring that naturalness together for my ears.
Hmm.
So maybe before we listen to this, can you tell us how he heard the electronic work and how he was able to integrate that in a different way from the way I might?
Well, as my 5-year-old daughter likes to say, I don't know what he heard because I am not him. But we would try out effects in the studio. We'd take an instrument, play it, process the sound, and he'd either say, I like that, keep it, or I don't like that, try something else.
Okay.
So this is just kind of one set of choices that he was pleased with at the moment.
All right, one step along the way, as you said, a work in progress. And say his name so we can hear it very carefully said. I've been faking it for a few weeks here.
Wayan Sadra.
Oh, faked it pretty well. Here it is, work in
progress. I should say, in Balinese it would be Sadra, but Sadra is okay. Thank you.
A work in progress for various gamelan instruments and electronics by E.Y.N. Sutter, by Mr. First Sutter.
Yeah.
You're explaining the birth name.
Mr. Eighth Born.
Eighth Born Sutter. And done in 1991 at the Bregman Studios at Dartmouth. And that was, you were responsible for putting that together, were you, and helped them direct that recording?
Well, I was playing one of the instruments, uh-huh. and I, along with Larry, obtained the money from the NEA International Program to fund Sutter's residency.
You provided pockets, I see.
May they rest in peace, yes.
And one of the questions I'd asked earlier was what was going on in his mind when he was working on that. And
we have a very good
we have an excerpt
that,
here.
Just a bit of this, bit. It's Work in Progress by Eighth Born. Reflections on a first experience in electronic music. How can I describe my feelings? When I first saw the high-tech equipment at the Bregman Studio at Dartmouth College, my heart sank. It was as if I were a powerless grain of sand adrift upon a vast desert. I felt suddenly surrounded by a tornado. All kinds of information, some of which I could understand and some of which I could not understand at all. Maybe this was caused by ignorance or by difficulties with the language. With the language. Because of the situation, in the early days of visiting the studio, I felt I had entered a bad dream. In an imaginary world, I did not comprehend. My experience with computer or electronic music up until then had been limited to taking instructions from other composers, but without understanding the results of the process. For example, when I worked with Larry Polanski and Pauline Oliveris at Telluride, composer to composer conference in 1990. I wonder how much he had to pay for that. Well,
that's expensive. Oh, my goodness.
Ooh, well, perhaps this was partly why I had a narrow view of electronic music. Thinking of it as merely a sound, like ringing in the ears, 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 like ringing. But now the situation was very different. Perhaps it was my desire to know more that pushed me to... Is this enough of this? Or would you like if I...
Just a tad more. Of the particular answer we were searching for.
This made me happy! Because I had not even imagined that the results would be like that. Did I skip over too much? No. I listened to the recording many times at Larry Polanski and Judy Diamond's house. In my imagination, I envisioned a mantra or sacred chanting during one section, while another section evoked a complex ka-ka-ka of interlocking parts. How could I express my... of interlocking parts. Yes, he asked me what I was doing in Hanover. I think if I read one sentence per paragraph, we can get this through. It seems that my friend was prematurely going to demand that studio. I think this assumption, the significance of this statement. One time, Jody Diamond introduced about electronic music of sounds. I also realized that I might in Indonesia, because I was so familiar with the sounds of gamelan consideration. It is not that different from the creative process. Yet how would the ideas I had encountered on a conceptual level, even though it was something I could understand? The end. Did I miss something?
Not at all.
That was an abbreviated version.
Abbreviated and dramatized version of the comments of EY and Sandra on that composition. All right.
I guess you want to ask me again, really.
I won't. We should do our belated station identification. You are listening to the Calvos and Damien New Music Sesquihour Expansive.
As if you didn't know.
On WGDR.
Plainberry.
Good try. Plainfield. One of those towns. Let's listen to more.
Shall we go on with our Sadra theme or our strange music from Indonesian composers?
Let's hear. You,
aren't
you
they
said
really
you,
the same?
Well, let me hear something. You've done something you just mentioned at the beginning to me while we were off the air.
Well, everything that Larry and I brought with us today is generally unavailable in the outside world. We used to do a show on KPFA radio in Berkeley called The Thin Edge of the Wedge. And our theme was, if you can get it out there, you won't hear it here. there should be some place for things that don't really exist yet to have their voice. So that's... you don't exist yet, and here we are. So another thing I brought that doesn't really exist, and so I'm not playing it, is just like the symphony that you opened your show with.
That's
it's not
right.
being played.
And will not be heard.
Will not be heard.
Especially if you keep holding it and don't give it to me.
A gamelan piece that I kind of co-composed long distance with Virgil Thompson via the hand of Lou Harrison. I was teaching at Mills College, where I'd come to work with Lou, who I'd known for quite a bit. I actually helped him write his first piece for Javanese gamelan.
Give us 30 seconds on Lou Harrison, because he's such an important figure in a composition and opening the ears of people.
Lou is one of our national living treasures, if we were a smart enough country to have such things. He's in his 70s now, and he's been a composer for a long time. And he was a contemporary of John Cage. Yes. They worked together and kind of invented percussion music for break drums and things like that, and were very active. And I kind of think of Lou as following the path of melody in his work. And... somewhere along the way, he had encountered gamelan music. He traveled a lot in Asia and Korea. When did he write Pacifica Rondo?
64, right.
He wrote a fantastic piece called Pacifica Rondo, which was he wrote on the boat going to Asia to study music. And I think of Lou as having the fantastic ability to hear other musics and then incorporate the spirit of them
yes,
in his music.
Absolutely.
Not to imitate them, not to borrow things or steal things, but to just somehow bring them into his own creativity and have something come out that's quite amazing. And he had, of course, encountered the Indonesian gamelan through his work with Henry Cowell.
Right.
And built some instruments kind of similar, kind of like the West Coast Dennis Murphy in a way. It's like, why can't I make some of these?
Looks
sure,
like him a little bit, too, as I recall.
Looks like him somewhat. And built gamelan instruments and wrote for them. But it was only in the mid-70s when he encountered the person who was also my first Javanese teacher, KRT Wasito Diningrat, who we all call Pak Chokro, that Lou was actually first invited to write for Javanese instruments per se. And that's when he and I started our association, because I was working as the teaching assistant for my Javanese teacher, and then Lou came to our group to learn how to write for those instruments.
Okay. And now, how did that lead to what we're about to hear?
Well, Lou eventually had a position at Mills College in Oakland, California, and part of his job there, his plan and vision, was to build a large aluminum gamelan.
Aluminum.
That's the metal of choice for him. It's very inexpensive. It's easy to tune. A lot of different
reasons.
Soft
and workable. And,
right. And it's funny that what's a junk metal for us is so expensive in Indonesia that no instrument builders build out of aluminum there. But anyway, so Lou had built this very large, beautiful aluminum gamelan named C. Darius C. Madeline after Darius Milhaud. And he had been trying to get his very close friend, Virgil Thompson, to write a piece for gamelan for a long time. And
Virgil Thompson has not had high marks on this show, so I hope you
really
can change our minds here with this piece.
Well, I don't know. Virgil kept saying, absolutely not. I don't know anything about gamelan. I won't write for it. And he refused and refused. And finally, Lou thought of a way to trick him. He said, well, Virgil, you could write me a 16-measure hymn tune, couldn't you? Well, yes, of course, I could do that. So Virgil wrote him a hymn tune, and Lou wrote it down and converted it to Javanese number notation and gave it to me and said, okay, Jody, press line one. Way down at the bottom there, the red light. There you go. Giving phone lessons in the middle of things here. Lou said, okay, Jody, turn this into a gamelan piece. And by the way, for the text, you have to use cute little aphorisms that Virgil has always said, like money inspires, success is mellowing, and it's important to have something that will work for you the next day, and things like that. So I was given this list of little texts and this kind of 32-beat hymn melody and instructed to gamelanize it. So I wrote all the instrumental parts, and I wrote a little inserted song, which is in three parts, one 10 beats, one 8 beats, one 7 beats long, that uses those words. And then this piece was performed at Mills College. And Virgil actually came and heard it at one time, and he said, oh, it's okay.
So what do you do? You get the composer credit? He gets the composer credit? How does this work?
We split it.
Okay.
We split it. Jody Diamond and Virgil Thompson.
And
the piece is called Gending Chelsea. It's named after the building in New York City that Virgil lived in for a very long time. It was premiered at Mills, and then this is a recording that is slated to be released on the Music Masters label, but is not yet out.
Here it is, after that story. This is going to be a very intriguing tune, Gending Chelsea by Jody Diamond and Virgil Thompson.
Thank you.
by Jody Diamond and Virgil Thompson. That was Gending Chelsea. Interesting combination, indeed. Larry Polanski is now sitting in.
Go ahead. Knock Virgil. Say something derogatory about poor old Virg.
I don't have to. We've played his music before.
You're right.
Takes care of it. And Larry has joined us. Jody has taken the other seat in front of the computer console, and we're about to have. There it is. Is it time for the quiz? Yes. Well, the music is playing. We hear it playing in the background. So we have a guest initiated quiz on the Calvos and Damien show together.
Now we can't hear it, Dennis. So,
well, that's all right. Sure.
Change the different scales here.
There it goes.
Try and guess what they are. If you want multiple choice.
Should I explain what we're listening to?
Oh, please do.
Well, this is a piece of kids' computer music software that I wrote about a week ago. It's called Anna's Music Box. And this is a kind of a bonehead gamelan setting that I...
Bonehead gamelan.
That's what I call it, in deference to my wife. That is, it's a little music box that kids can play with and change the sounds, and it runs on a Macintosh. And I discovered I could make it sound like a kind of a crummy gamelan pretty easily, so I did that for Jody just to annoy her.
Why is this annoying? Explain to me. Why.
Well, actually, I should thank Jody and my daughter Anna helped me sort of beta test this at home over a couple of days. So what Jody's doing, I guess, is changing. You can kind of change the moods, which are basically just scales of the program. You can switch between different scales, and it just kind of noodles in different scales in lots of different ways. And now it's making these sort of farting sounds. So I guess the quiz is, Jody, to guess what scale we're in at a given moment?
Yes, well, dial up 4. I don't know. I have not a clue. And maybe you do. 454-7762. That's 1-802-GLIPSOB. Give us a call and tell us what you want to reiterate that quiz again? 454-7762.
Should we be giving something away, though?
We are. We always give something away. We have a prize.
Give David away? Send David.
Available.
Damien is available for a New Year's Eve date. As long as you go to Burlington and go here, Ahmed lives in Istanbul and drives a taxi, a new composition that will be premiered by the what?
I'd rather not go into that.
On New Year's Eve, that first night, yes. But back to the quiz, 454-7762. Please call us and identify the...
The scale. Yeah, and I don't think there's a sesquilidian scale in there, but I'll put one in when I go home.
Let's listen.
There's a Lydian.
Lydia, my Lydia. And so here we are. We'll just turn ourselves down. We'll just vanish in there. 454-7762. Have a listen. Available? Are you making this software?
Yeah, it's going to be on the web. It's freeware. And
great.
It'll soon be in its first major installation in Mrs. Bergeron's kindergarten class at School Street School in Lebanon, where I'm hoping to have some very expert beta testers whip it into shape.
Trying to break it for you? Break the software.
They'll sign non-disclosure agreements.
Where will we find it? Will we find it at the Bregman Studios?
No, it'll be on my website as soon as I... get it together to throw it on.
All right.
It'll be free.
Well, you folks out there want to, you look up New Music Vermont. We have a music resources page, and as soon as Larry Polanski's software becomes available, we'll link it to it. So.
And it's guaranteed. It doesn't have any bugs. It doesn't do anything.
It's guaranteed.
Yeah.
What do they get back?
They get their money back. They get David. But it's a lot of fun. It's something I've always wanted, because my daughter, and Jody's 5-year-old daughter, too, likes to play at the computer when I write new software. So I decided to write her something that was really something just for her, and this is that.
Well, right now it's sort of quacking at us.
Well, that's, I can't do anything about Jody. I she's out of my control. She's not even paying attention to us, is she?
I think she's given up on us.
Well, maybe we should hear some more direct goal-oriented music.
Goal-oriented. I'm for that. Well, I have to ask the questions first while we listen to this in the background. Larry Polansky, you arrived into the Eastern Cold establishment from the West Coast, and let's have a little bit of your background, because I first heard of you when I got some interesting stuff in the mail, and I said, oh, who is this guy? And so tell us a little bit about who this guy is.
That must have been some of those obscene letters I was sending out.
Well, not that sad.
I'm, as you say, I was living in California for about 10 years before I came here. Which is where Jody and I met, and I also worked at Mills College at a place called the Center for Contemporary Music at Mills, which is a venerable old experimental music studio.
Indeed, yes.
With a lot of wonderful people have been there, and that was a great 10 years, very productive and fertile and very interesting. And then we got a great opportunity to come east to teach at Dartmouth, and took it, and we've been very happy ever since we've been here, and it's also been equally productive. It's been kind of fun to switch coasts and have a new set of friends on the East Coast than on the West Coast, and a lot of people who we had sort of lost contact with in New York and Boston are now frequent collaborators. In fact, that's some of the things since the theme of the show is sort of collaboration, I thought I'd bring some things that I've done recently with people here.
Great. Just to sort of remind some of the listeners who have heard the show, we have played a couple of your pieces. We played excerpts from The World's Longest Melody on the show, and Bereshit as well.
Oh, wonderful.
We played all of that.
That's
a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous piece, yes.
Yeah. That's Jody singing.
Yes, indeed. One of ours, too.
That's our old road piece. That was our gigging piece. You know, we played it at bars. let's see. The first piece I brought, this is also really hot off the press. This is a collaboration between myself and Daniel Good. Yeah, it's on Dan. A New York clarinetist and composer, and one of my favorite composers. And this piece has a kind of a story to it. It also is a compositional collaboration between myself and Iwayan Sadra. When I was living in Indonesia with Jody, Sadra was about our best friend, and I would spend hours and hours talking with him about composition and theory and whatever. And I was commissioned by a choir in Australia, actually, to write a piece for them. And I decided to take to do something that involved choir and gamelan and all kinds of stuff and computer and et cetera. And I took a Woody Guthrie tune named Ranger's Command, which is a great song and kind of unique in Woody Guthrie's output for its gender instincts. It's a very interesting tune. It's about a woman warrior. And there's also a very beautiful dance in Central Java that we would see a lot called the Bedoyo, which is also about women warriors. A very slow-moving, formal, just fantastic classical Javanese court dance. So I decided to use...
Why do I hear a musical morphing about
that
happening?
You got it. You know, my reputation precedes me. So I took the Woody Guthrie tune, and I yanked Sadra into my room there, and I said, Sadra, here's the Woody Guthrie tune. Now you write one. It was in Palog, one of the Javanese scales. Write one that I can morph between. And he understood what that meant because I was doing a lot of it, and I would always talk to him about some of the ideas. So he wrote a beautiful tune that's very similar to Ranger's Command, which is kind of a waltz. The piece was performed a couple of times, and it was performed when we got back from Indonesia by Gamelan Son of Lion in New York. With Jody singing, and Dan Good is one of the founding members of Gamelan Son of Lion, and at the time he was putting together what he calls his Interesting Melodies Project, which is just a set of solo
clarinet. Interesting Melodies Project, that's great.
It's great, yeah. It's a set of solo clarinet pieces, not his, other people's, which are just melodies that Tom Johnson's pieces, for example, are part of this. And he really wanted to do Bedoyo, because it is just a long melody that morphs between Sadra and Guthrie in various ways. So he made a solo clarinet version, which he's been performing all over the world, just sort of solo. Recently, we had the opportunity to do a collaborative residency at PASS in New York, and we decided to do...
That's the studio.
Yeah.
Studio there.
It's a public access studio.
Yeah.
Great place. And we there's a version of this piece that I've always wanted to do, which was to take Dan's version for clarinet, which is really his own composition, kind of, and combine it with the original Gendaire part, which is one of the gamelan instruments that I've always played when we've done it, and also three kamanak, Javanese kamanak, which are handheld kind of metallic sounding instruments. You'll hear them. So we actually made a new recording of this piece, which is a kind of a third version of a piece called Bedoyo Sadra, Bedoyo Guthrie, but really also Dan Good is the co-composer. And it's him on clarinet and me on Gendaire and both of us on kamanak, and the engineer is Alex Noyes from New York, who's wonderful.
All right, let's hear it. Bedoyo Sadra, Bedoyo Guthrie.
Something like that.
Something yeah. like that. Here it is. Thank you. Oh, we better give that title again. Badayo Guthrie. No, Badayo Sandra. Badayo Guthrie. That's, your microphone. There it is.
And that's with Daniel Good on clarinet. And also, he's really one of the co-composers because he sort of takes this giant choral piece and makes it into a shorter solo clarinet version. And I guess Jody's back there noodling. Is that
she's,
right?
She's back there noodling. Well, as soon as I, you know, sort of make sure things are connected, we'll hear her noodling. Oh, there she is.
I wrote this software for 5-year-olds, but it turns out that my wife is really likes it.
Well, I'm getting in line here.
I'm going to market it as put it in pizza parlors as a kind of a Mortal Kombat kind of thing. And the quiz is still on, but we've decided, I guess, to only take the fifth caller.
That's only the fifth caller, because all the callers we've had so far have not gotten the right answer. And the question, of course, is at 454-7762. And if you can tell in this register what scale this is.
Which is something that nobody in this room could do. So
that's right.
When we were thinking about doing this show, it seemed like a fun thing to do, to not play stuff that was sort of out on CD and available, and also emphasize the idea of collaborations, because you've got Jody and I
right.
who collaborate a lot, and, you know, not just doing the dishes, but...
How the heck do you do a collaboration, an artistic collaboration, and like each other?
Let's not talk about
okay.
that.
Okay.
There's not enough time on this show. This room isn't big enough. To, We do different things, and we do support each other's work as much as possible. But, you know, it's the idea of working with your friends and sort of a big family of artists is really important to us. And so I thought it would be fun to bring some of my favorite artists who I collaborate with. And this next one, he really is one of my two or three favorite composers ever, and also one of our best friends, a guy named David Mahler, who lives in Seattle. And is really well known among composers, especially among experimental American composers, but has never kind of made it out of the Seattle area too much, because he doesn't like to travel. He loves Seattle, and he's such a warm and kind of composer of such high integrity that he doesn't really promote himself very much. And that's sort of part of his charm, and also part of his charm is he does a lot of different things, not all of which are readily classifiable as kind of classical music. One of the things he does, for example, is run a big 20s orchestra called the Volunteer Park Conservatory Band.
Ooh.
Which does like Whiteman charts.
Oh, great.
And he does tons of things. And one of the things he does most beautifully is songs. He writes songs and sings them. Some of them are kind of folk songs, and some of them are art songs. And he also performs other people's art songs. About 10 years ago, David called me and asked if I could come up to Seattle and just simply play on a few of the songs that he was recording. He had got some money together and was recording a few of the songs. And one of the songs, I said yes immediately because I would do anything with David. And one of them is one of Jody and my favorite songs. We sing it all the time. It's called Elvis is Watching You.
We're going to hear something on this show that we can sing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
I think you'll like it, too. It's a great tune.
I don't know if
it's
I can
a waltz.
This.
It's called Elvis is Watching.
Oh, inside it's a waltz.
It's beautiful. Tune.
Here on the Calvos and Damien New Music Sesquire on WGDR Plainfield, we are about to hear something singable.
Are you ready for commercial success? And it's a pretty good country band up in Seattle playing with David, and I'm playing guitar. And then, because David also used to be the music on a kind of a Prairie Home Companion type show up in Seattle.
We don't mention that show.
Oh, sorry. Can we talk about that car talk show? Is that okay?
That's all right.
It's sort of closer to what you're doing.
It sounds like guys in a restaurant. Yeah. That's okay.
So David was, and the band from that show, a violinist and a rhythm guitarist are on this recording. And then while we were in the studio, we did a second tune of David's called Christmas Time of Year. and this is really, that one is really just David and I and a sax player. I'm playing mandolins and guitars and steel guitar and things like that. So we'll hear both of these. And these, David released these as kind of a private cassette single, I guess, is that what you call them?
Yeah, I suppose.
Two different cassette singles with another tune of David's on the flip side.
They're definitely private. They have this magic marker written
right
on them.
You can tell. I love these a lot. So I guess we'll hear Elvis, and then we'll hear Christmas.
Elvis is watching you first. It's a Saugus Newhall Band. Is that the pickup name?
That
for
band
this?
Was together for about 3 hours.
3 hours, right, with David Mahler's Elvis is Watching You, followed by Christmas Time of Year.
Appropriate.
Look on the night sky, the stars above. Couples on earth who are close in love. Couples be faithful, caring and true. Elvis is watching you. You know the message he brings you. Be kind to each other along life's way. Someone's beside you, well, you know who. Elvis is watching you. Someone has been through your joy and your pain. Elvis knows just what you're feeling. Take her out dancing at midnight, go far. You're never too old to hold him to the dark. With your radio down low, it's a sweet rendezvous. And Elvis is watching. Can fail to hear.
songs we choose, we'll spread the news, it's Christmas time of year. The candles glow, we might have snow, each anthem falls with comfort on the ear. Good friends inspire this ragtag choir at Christmas time of year. Share the glad times and all the sad times to disappear. On the telephone, there's a call from home, and childhood Christmas memories reappear. Those songs you knew, they still ring through at Christmas time of year. Oh, miles apart, we join our hearts, loved ones sing Noel's forever dear. Each sweet refrain completes the chain at Christmas time of year.
By Virgil Thompson. No, not Virgil Thompson. music by David Mahler. Elvis is Watching You and Christmas Time of Year. And that last arrangement by Larry Polanski, our 0.5 family values character for today. Well, that was
Interesting.
It was certainly singable for
Sesqu-
the Calvos.
It was very Sesqu.
Yes, it was Sesqu indeed. You promised us something serious.
Sesquiserious. It's, yeah. Well...
Expansive. So.
Let's see. Since the third member of our family is not with us, I thought she could be represented. And what we'll hear now is three very short pieces. They're all using my daughter Anna's voice. And they range of about the last 2 or 3 years. One of them is actually out on CD. It's the first thing we played today that you could actually buy, but I don't know where you'd find it. And I call them collectively three Anna studies. Well, the first one was made using a recording of her voice when she was 6 months old, and it's just one scream in a very bad mood, as I like to say. And the piece, which is only a minute long, is just that screen sort of taken apart and recombined, and et cetera.
Okay.
The second one is called Four Voice Canon Number 9.
Ah, one of the Four Voice Canons. We played number 4 last week.
Really? Well, the hits just keep on coming. And this one uses 5 short vocal sounds when she was, I guess, 3. None of them are words. There's like a breath and things like that. And it's a four voice canon in the same way all my other four voice canons are four voice canons, which I don't want to go into.
The studio isn't big enough, as you said. Yeah, right.
And it's about 4 minutes long, and it's 2 years old. And then the final one is the most recent piece, and it's called Baba Birthday, Have You Any Star? And it's based on my daughter Anna's voice and also her friend Eleanor's voice, and I recorded them just singing songs to each other, and they're singing like Puff the Magic Dragon and Happy Birthday and Baba Black Sheep and Twinkle Twinkle, thus the title. Those are all the same tune.
A bit exploitive.
Yeah, I know.
Children getting any residuals?
They're getting union scale. They get credits. Yeah, I named her Eleanor Wilson is the second 5-year-old. And what I do is I wrote some, most of these pieces use my own software to play around with the sounds. And this third one uses some software I wrote which does morphing like I did with the melody in the other piece, but this morphs sounds. So it's this third piece, which is only a minute and a half long, works with changing their voices into each other. And I thought one of the nice things about it is when you sing Happy Birthday to someone, you have to say their name. So when Anna sings it, it's Eleanor, and when Eleanor sings it, it's Anna. Except the first time Anna sang it, she forgot Eleanor's name and said, Happy birthday, dear anyone. But I eventually got her to say Eleanor's name, and so a lot of it is based on morphing each of them saying each other's names into their other names, if that makes any sense. You'll get the idea. So these are 3 short pieces, about a minute, about 4 minutes, and about 1.5 minutes.
3 Honest Studies by Larry Polansky. And we'll ask you about software when we get back to it. Here they are.
Thank you.
Three Anna Studies by Larry Polansky. Oh, gosh, those are really interesting pieces.
Thank you.
Tell me about the software. What does the software do? And you wrote the software.
Well, boy, this is a big...
30 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I should preface it by saying that as long as I've been composing, I've been writing software for composing. So it's always been kind of one and the same activity for me. And I have a certain aesthetic about software, which has always been focused around writing my own, rolling your own. That is, if you write your own, you get to kind of have a little bit of control over what happens. But the first of those three pieces was the first piece I ever did using purely somebody else's software. And again, another collaborative idea of my good friend Tom Erb, who wrote a program called SoundHack.
Yeah.
And we're very close friends, and we've collaborated on a lot of things. And I said, as a tribute to him, I'll just use his stuff in a piece, and I did the first piece. In the second piece, I used my own software, HMSL, as the kind of composing engine, and then used SoundHack and another program called C-Sound just for a little mixing. But it's mainly a computer-composed piece. That's the four-voice canon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of the idea there was a kind of a mind meld between three different pieces of software.
So you use your software much in the manner someone would use an instrument.
Often I do, yeah. I mean, or as a kind of a second brain.
Second brain.
Not that I have a good first one, but and the third one is all this mutation software, this sound morphing software. But that's actually now shareware. It's part of SoundHack, and you can download it off the web. So you could. There's nothing used in any of those pieces that's not basically public domain or shareware.
Okay. We're running toward the end of our time, so Jody has given us a new piece here to play. This is Tony Proboha. Proboha. I'll have to work on that one. Tony Proboha. Experiment Composisi Corobotan? Close? All right, I'll take it. Robitussin. Now let's listen to that, and you can give us a rundown about it after we've heard some of it. This is a piece for bass flutes. Bass recorders and a few other instruments that I can't read off this list. Let's just listen to them and get back to it in just a little bit. Thank you. so close to the end of the show at this point that I'm going to have to sort of bring that down a little bit and ask you, Jody, a little bit about it, about the piece and what we're hearing.
Tony Prabowo is one of the composers I met when I did a year-long survey of Indonesian composers back in 1989. And I tracked him down in Jakarta, where he'd been doing a lot of film and theater music. And his music's really fantastic. He does a lot of multi-track of mixed instruments and voices. It's too bad we didn't get to the end of this. There's a great kind of mixed vocal choir singing Javanese poetry. But maybe we'll do that on our next Goddard College Gamelan concert.
Ooh,
and people can come and, come and help me sing it.
Now, when's that?
Well, the Goddard College Gamelan does a concert every semester. So
right,
this spring
there was one recently. So.
Yes, there was one, and we'll be doing one this spring, and also we'll be having a community gamelan group for composers, performers, musicians, and people who are interested in working with those instruments. And they can get in touch with me when the semester starts, which is the end of January.
And you'll be here. So
and we'll be here.
To find
so,
you.
It's an open-door policy. Well, they can leave a message for me at the switchboard, 454-8311, I believe it is, the Goddard College main number.
Okay, leave a message for Jody Downs.
Call, say you want to get a postcard when the community gamelan begins. So I did find Tony, and I was working on collecting music from Indonesian composers so I could inform people, just like the people listening today, about the experiments that were going on there. We sat in his house and dubbed things that he had that he'd been working on. And actually, last year he came to Seattle and worked with a gamelan group there, Gamelan Pacifica, on a big multimedia work for shadow puppets and Balinese gamelan, Javanese gamelan, and dancers and stuff. And that was a piece called Visible Religion, which is now out on videotape if anyone's interested.
Well, we're listening to it in the background. I know you don't have the phones on, so you can't hear it, but the choir
oh, you
is
can hear them
hands.
Coming. Oh, that's good. One of the things that Tony told me when I interviewed him about the challenges facing experimental composers in Indonesia was that it's fine if you write new music for gamelan, you might get a chance to work in a theater piece. He said, but boy, if you write for Western instruments, you really have a lot of trouble getting your music played.
It's the same for us. What's the news? Anyway, that's we're listening to the end of Tony Prabowo's Experiment Composisi. Karawa time. It's so lovely. We have to get ourselves gone. And on our way out, we certainly would like to thank Jody Diamond and Larry Polansky for joining us today on the show. This has been an absolute delight. Great pleasure. And all too serious.
Next time, snacks, please.
Yes, next time, snacks. And next week, please join us for Joel Chatterby, who will be up here a long way from the southern end of the state. And we will fade right into a piece of Joel's. Here comes.
Production of Baltic Media.